reckless far-left politicians continue to push the destructive message that our nation and our law enforcement are oppressive or racist.
The U.S. president pushes his law and order message. It's Thursday, September 3rd, and this is VOA Asia. I'm Ira Melman. Also ahead, you'll hear from some experts on what the United States could do to improve its race relations. We take you to a college town to see what the pandemic has done. Pol Pot's premier executioner and security chief, who oversaw mass murder in Cambodia, is dead. And Australia is in recession. It is all on today's VOA Asia. Ignoring local officials' concerns over racial tensions, President Donald Trump visited Kenosha, Wisconsin, the site of violent protests triggered by the shooting of a black man by a white police officer last month, pushing his campaign message of law and order. White House correspondent Patsy Wittikoswara has this story.
Protests and counter-protests greeted President Donald Trump's visit to Kenosha, Wisconsin, following violent unrest over the police shooting of Jacob Blake on August 23rd. The black man was shot 7 times in the back by a white police officer trying to arrest him. Defying statements from the Kenosha mayor and Wisconsin governor, who say the president's visit will trigger more racial tension, Trump toured a business area burnt down during the unrest.
And we're going to help them a lot. I think we're going to help them a lot.
Trump met with law enforcement, but not the Blake family. He pushed a message of law and order to tamp down months of sometimes violent protests around the country, wading deeper into the debate over racial tension ahead of the November election. This week, Trump suggested that a white teenager accused of fatally shooting 2 people with a semi-automatic weapon during the Kenosha unrest may have acted in self-defense, prompting more criticism, including from Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden.
Fires are burning and we have a president who fans the flames rather than fighting the flames. But we must not burn. We have to build.
Trump blamed Democrats for enabling the violence, which he called domestic terror.
Reckless far-left politicians continue to push the destructive message that our nation and our law enforcement are oppressive or racist.
The president's response to racial unrest is becoming a key election issue, with some research suggesting it may motivate black voters to come to the polls. But despite the Trump campaign's laser focus on law and order, ultimately it may not change many minds. Omar Wasso is a professor of political science at Princeton University, focusing on race and politics.
Support, particularly among whites, for the protest movement has declined somewhat. But in a highly polarized country, Trump's base of support is stable, Biden's base of support is stable, and we're just not seeing that much movement despite news events.
Still, the Trump campaign is making an appeal to white suburban voters concerned by the violence, particularly in swing states such as Wisconsin. Patsy Wittikoswara, VOA News.
Recently, a panel of former national security professionals explored the role that race and racism play in office diplomatic and security practices and what might be done to improve things. VOA's Adam Phillips reports.
Anne-Marie Slaughter moderated the online discussion. A one-time director of policy planning for the U.S. State Department, she is CEO of New America, the Washington-based think tank that organized the event.
Our mission is renewing the promise of America by continuing the quest to live up to our highest ideals. And that, in many ways, is what this moment is about. The complete exposure of the gap between who we are and who we say we are and who we want to be, but we are manifestly not. How do we address that as a national security community? What needs to change?
Michelle Flournoy was Undersecretary of Defense for Policy under President Barack Obama. In her view, real change won't begin until more diversity of race, of gender, of ethnic group is represented in the corridors of power. At this time, that goal seems distant for African Americans. 93% of top U.S. federal officials are white. Among the 41 most senior military commanders, only 2 are black. And while blacks make up nearly 15% of America's workforce, only 6% are in the career foreign service. Flournoy says that is a tragic waste of talent. She recalls that in the Obama White House, a wide, even unorthodox range of views and backgrounds was welcomed.
Someone comes in with a dissenting view. Someone questions the assumption that groupthink is starting to form around. Just that diversity of perspective that consistently, I think, helped the president make better decisions.
American public diplomacy through government media can be crucial in helping people abroad forge an emotional connection to the U.S., for good or sometimes bad. For example, when people abroad see racial and social injustice in the U.S., it undercuts America's ability to credibly promote human rights and democracy on the world stage. Ambassador Bonnie Jenkins is founder and president of the nonprofit group Women of Color Advancing Peace, Security, and Conflict Transformation. She says America must look in the mirror.
Do we really know it all? Are we the best people to go around the world and dictate how things should be when we have so many questions at home? We do have a lot of problems. We see them, but we try to ignore them. Let's be honest about it, how we have been in other countries, how we have treated other countries, how we treat them, and how we treat ourselves, and look at that as a package. Who are we really? Who do we want to be? And do we have the courage to ask that question?
The soul searching continues. On August 23rd, another black man was shot by police and paralyzed from the waist down, prompting further protests and further heating the flashpoint in the presidential campaign. Adam Phillips, VOA News, New York.
We continue on VOA Asia. Children returned to school Tuesday in the central Chinese city of Wuhan, the original epicenter of the coronavirus epidemic. AP correspondent Charles de Ledesma has more.
According to state media, 1.4 million children have returned to nearly 3,000 kindergartens, primary and secondary schools as part of a nationwide return to classes. Life has largely returned to normal in Wuhan, where the novel coronavirus was first detected late last year. After what critics called an attempt to ignore the outbreak, the city underwent a 76-day lockdown. Wuhan marked a milestone on Sunday when its last confirmed case, a patient who brought the virus from overseas, was released from a city hospital. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
College towns across America are eager to see students return to classes this month and help local businesses recover from the coronavirus pandemic. But as Mariama Diallo reports, local business owners are also worried there will be a surge in new cases.
When the pandemic sent many of Michigan University's 40,000-plus students back home earlier this year, the college town's small business district felt it big time.
It was like a 3-foot blizzard without snow. So, you know, nobody walking on the sidewalks, nobody going up and down the streets.
The fall term begins with at least some in-person classes on campus. That's bringing both hope and anxiety to businesses which rely on the students to stay afloat. Adam Lowenstein is a bar owner.
I'm glad to see the students coming back. Like the first probably emotion is relief, you know, happiness.
Justin Herrick owns a restaurant.
My gut feel is people are going to come back. There's going to be a significant outbreak, and it's either going to be managed and contained, or you know they're going to hit the pause button and go all online. And I think my gut feel is probably the latter.
Jeff Saunders, the owner of a piercing parlor, says he's fought hard to keep his business going.
So the pandemic's really thrown a lot at us. And you have to really run your business extraordinarily well to succeed.
Not all places are back up and running. Espresso Royale Coffee, the once successful shop, is not coming back due to the pandemic, according to its website. Former customers like this Michigan U student are disappointed.
Yeah, it kind of sucks that those places are not opening up, especially Espresso Royale. There's a lot of people in my house that like that.
Perry Perico sits in the street outside one of his businesses in a makeshift patio area that didn't exist before the COVID-19 pandemic. Despite troubles, he remains optimistic.
I'm hoping and praying, and I believe that we're going to be okay. We're going to be okay.
Small business owners eager to see students and normalcy again. Mariama Diallo, VOA News.
India's coronavirus infections rose to almost 3.8 million on Wednesday as states continue to relax rules on movement despite the surge in cases. Olivia Chan reports.
The number of known coronavirus cases in India has risen to almost 3.8 million, on course to replace Brazil as the second highest in the world, even as the Asian country continues to relax its quarantine measures. In the southern city of Bengaluru, for example, thousands of pubs were set to serve alcohol starting from Tuesday, after a six-month gap. Elsewhere, Goa, a popular tourist destination, has recently relaxed quarantine rules to attract visitors. And authorities in the capital, New Delhi, are also due to meet on Wednesday to discuss the reopening of the city's metro, despite fresh cases there sitting at a two-month high. But like many other countries, India's economy has been hit hard by the virus. Its economy shrank by nearly a quarter in April to June, much more than forecast. Prime Minister Narendra Modi ordered a nationwide lockdown in March when the country was reporting less than 100 daily cases. Experts have praised Modi's early actions, but others have said the restrictions had been imposed too soon. If the country surpasses Brazil in cases, it will still lag far behind the number one spot, the United States.
That was Reuters' Olivia Chan. Continue on VOA Asia. Australian officials say the nation has officially fallen into a recession for the first time since the early 1990s. Lockdowns and other restrictions imposed to contain the spread of COVID-19 have affected most parts of the economy, and hundreds of thousands of jobs have been lost. From Sydney, Phil Mercer has more.
Australia's Treasurer calls it a crisis like no other, the country's worst downturn in decades. Data from the Australian Bureau of Statistics has shown that gross domestic product, or GDP, has fallen by 7% in the second quarter this year. It was worse than many economists had predicted. The coronavirus pandemic has adversely affected almost every sector, from retail and hospitality to mining, education and tourism. The result is Australia's first official recession in almost 30 years. Officials say there could be more pain to come. A second wave of infections in the state of Victoria, where strict lockdown measures have been reimposed, is likely to delay a recovery. Matthias Cormann is the Australian Finance Minister.
If you look at what's happening towards the end of June and early July, we were certainly heading in the right direction. Jobs were being restored across the economy and indeed across many sectors of the economy. Activity was picking up. But then, of course, the outbreak in Victoria happened. So what we desperately need is to continue to get on top of the outbreak in Victoria to open up the economy as much as we can, as soon as we can.
But the Australian economy was faltering before the coronavirus took hold, partly because of drought and bushfires. Unemployment is rising. The official jobless rate is 7.5%. The government has extended a multi-billion-dollar wage subsidy until March 2021. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
We continue on VOA Asia. The Khmer Rouge commander, known as Comrade Duch, Pol Pot's premier executioner and security chief who oversaw the mass murder of at least 14,000 Cambodians, died Wednesday. Gloria Tso reports.
Known as Comrade Duch, Kangwek Uv was former Prime Minister Pol Pot's premier executioner and security chief at the notorious Tuol Sleng prison. In the streets of Phnom Penh on Wednesday, locals like 66-year-old Chek Samwan reacted to the news.
I will never forget the horrible past or crimes that he committed, and he deserves to serve more prison terms. But now that he has died, I can forgive him, and his case is finished.
Duch was the first member of the Khmer Rouge leadership to face trial for his role in a regime responsible for at least 1.7 million deaths in the killing fields of Cambodia during the Khmer Rouge's reign of terror from 1975 to 1979.
That was Reuters correspondent Gloria Tso. Thanks for being with us. Thanks to our managing editor, Diane Gao, and our VOA Asia team, Jim Stevenson, Keith Lane, and Doug Bernard. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Stay safe and enjoy the day.